The following presentation was recorded at a Faith Builders colloquy. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Scenario 1. It's after school, and teachers know after school hours and what they're like. But it's time for an interview. And student X comes into the classroom, and along with him comes his mom and dad. They sit down. We talk a few minutes about how things are going. Question is asked, Student X, will you spend at least 1 hour minimum on your assignments so that you do not come to school with them finished, unfinished? Answer, absolutely not. I won't do it. Need for discipleship, I guess. Scenario 2, same school, different situation. Again, it's after school. It's a student who has notoriously not had their Bible memory done. Information was supposed to go home that if this is not completed next week, you stay after school. It's not completed. She's sitting in the classroom. Student Y in the classroom. Half an hour goes by. Suddenly charging into the school comes mom. What in the world do you think you're doing keeping my student after my child after school? I'm taking her home right now. I've had all I can take. Well, she walks. Have it your way. I guess we need some discipleship. Scenario 3. This time it's an ordained bishop's son. It's toward the end of his schooling. He's in 12th grade. He's about 1 week from graduating from high school. And we're talking about speech class. Suddenly, he says, I'm not giving the last speech. I just won't do it. I absolutely will not do it. Next scenario takes us to a school board meeting. It's a lot of discussion about boy-girl relationships. One of the board members this time has a son who sits in school, and he's about in 11th grade or something like this. And he has a friend, which he spends probably 20% of the time giving a deadpan, dead cow look at most of the day. And there erupts a rather heated discussion about how this should be handled. Next scenario. Again, it's after school, and again, it's in my room, and again, it's a student. This time, a foster child. His biological parents have rejected him, basically kicked him out of the house. So now he's in a foster home. The only difficulty is, in this foster home, the parents don't get along either. Dad is not a hard worker. Mom is a manipulator. There's a number of things of this nature. And so this child ends up in my room every Thursday afternoon, and we talk about life and how all of it has worked. People need discipleship. The last scenario that I would just like to kind of have you focus on for a moment. It's my office. It's the middle of the day. There's a boy in my office, and he's got problems. He's not getting along well in school. He's doing poorly academically. He's mean. He's nasty. He doesn't seem to have a heart for people at all. And we have been going around and around for about the last 6 months about this, trying everything that we know in the book to use on him, on student Z, I guess you might call him, including corporal punishment. And suddenly he turns to me and he says, well, you know, you don't treat me any different than my dad does. And I kind of back up surprised and say, okay, well, how does your dad treat you? Oh, and he gets angry. He throws hammers at me. Okay. Now, I was a lot more surprised than I acted. Yeah, he hits my mother now and then. And I suddenly realized that, yes, the dad needs some discipleship, the mom needs some discipleship, and the teacher who's trying to handle this needs it probably worse than anybody else. For 6 months, I've been working on this problem. Never occurred to me that this was the difficulty. Somehow I thought that he was just like any other ornery, mischievous boy who needed it knocked out of him somehow, you know, either by staying in at recess or paddling him or keeping him after school or having him write an essay or do this or do that, you know. Those of you who are school teachers, especially in administration, you know what I'm talking about. I think this is titled incorrectly, Discipleship of Parents, Board, School Staff, and Students. I think it probably is better titled Discipleship Among Parents, Board, School Staff, and Students. At least one of my points here to begin with is that if you as a teacher, or an administrator, or a pastor, or anybody, or a dad, or a mom, think that you do not stand in need of being challenged and discipled and instructed and loved by other people, you're very foolish. You sure do. And so what I have to say this morning is certainly not directed at everybody who is not doing the job well. It's a lot of reflection of what I feel down inside and what I sense myself when faced with the challenges of working out the things in flesh that Milo was talking about this morning. When he went down through that list of things, I thought, oh yeah, that's right. But what happens when you're right there on the spot and you need to respond to the child who has the problem that's going on deep down in his heart, or the parent who has been angry for years and years and years and years, and now it's just all kind of coming out in this experience that you're finding yourself in, or the ordained bishop who for a long time has not been living too consistently himself, and this is now just being expressed in his child who is in your classroom, and you're called upon to somehow make some sense of all of this. I suppose that my purpose this morning is to talk about discipleship relationships within the context of the Christian school, and I hope to kind of stay focused on that, but I'll probably kind of go back and forth between the larger community and the Christian school. In the 1950s and the 1960s and the 1970s, I guess, when the Christian school movement got going, snowballing, there were a lot of surprises that were involved with that. One of them was we weren't sure where to find teachers. Another one was, and maybe a bigger one and a better one, was that it brought to sharp focus the difficulties and the problems that we experience in our communities. I don't lay any claim to being at the most strategic spot in the community, but I can tell you that the school is probably the place where you will find brought to the sharpest focus and most often exposure to the difficulties and problems that exist in the leadership in your church, in the parents, in the husband-wife relationships in the community, in the dad-to-son, the mother-to-daughter relationships. There you are going to find these things probably magnified and coming to the sharpest focus. And in the end, I say this with a certain amount of tongue in cheek, but in the end, maybe the Christian school will function better as a forum, as a platform, as a staging area for discipleship throughout the community. Maybe it will serve that purpose better than it will even to train the child in how to figure out what 6 plus 4 is. I wonder. Certainly, my intention here is not to take from the ordained leadership in our communities the right, the responsibility, the duty, and everything that goes along with it to lead in pastoring and discipling and loving the community and drawing them together into a discipleship relationship. I want you to know that. Because I do feel as though that is their first and primary responsibility and not the school principal's job nor the teacher's nor the school board's problem. However, my experience has been that for some reason, the place where it is the most sharply focused is in the school. And so if you can somehow bring pastors into that relationship or into that situation, I think it would be very, very, very good. Probably best. I think it is Brother Fox down in Reading who has been campaigning for the last couple of years that every school needs a pastor. And he enlarges in what he means by that. And I have come to believe that that is very, very, very true. I don't intend on focusing on methods this morning, but rather on form and structure. I think what's on my heart is that it's not that that people do not want discipleship. It is not that people don't want to give it. I don't view our people as being bad people who intentionally just don't want to do these things. I'm not saying there aren't some. But I don't think that's the case. I think rather there just isn't a forum. There just isn't a staging area. There just is not time and place for it, it seems. And so when I'm thinking about discipleship among parents, board, school staff, and students this morning, I want to think about how we can maximize the school as a place or a staging area where, in fact, active discipleship can happen in the community. Again, be careful to understand me. We do not take from the church and its leadership and its structure its rightful role in this. In fact, we draw them into it. We only, again, provide a forum for it to happen. See, in too many communities, the opportunity is almost non-existent. How many of you are familiar with what I call the ABMS syndrome, the annual business meeting syndrome in the church? I'm very familiar with it. What happens? All of the things that should have been talked about for the last months and years, things that people have been holding grievances for a long time, just wait till that annual meeting, I'm going to say it. When I get there, I'm going to say what's on my heart. I'm going to straighten this thing out. I'm telling you. And so what happens? Now, maybe this is not your experience, but I have seen this in my adult years in my home community way too often. So there you go. You get to this annual business meeting syndrome situation. You sit down and you start the meeting, or whoever the presiding officer stands up to start this thing, and everybody knows that there are one or two or three issues that are as a hot potato. And when it gets in the right hands, it's going to get hot. But the little formalities occur, you know, and you do your prayer thing and you do your other little itty-bitty things, and then there's kind of a silence begins to reign. And you're just waiting for somebody to bring that issue up, which you know full well is going to cause another long moment of silence. And then finally somebody's going to kind of in a quivery voice and maybe almost just a little shakily cut loose with what they have been wanting to say for a long time. Why does that happen? There isn't any other forum. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be, and I'm not saying if somebody wasn't on the ball that there wouldn't be, but The community is not structured. It does not think, in other terms. They think that this problem with where the lavatories are supposed to be placed or whatever is going to happen has to be solved in that business meeting. And they know that Brother A and Brother B don't agree on this, and somehow they've even gotten into a big hassle about it. And they're not talking, but they will talk at that annual business meeting. Now, that's got to be the wrong way to go about this, doesn't it? That can't be the right way to do it. But it helps you, I hope it helps you to see what I want to talk about this morning, and that is somehow we have to build a foundation under us that will make it possible for us to talk to our parents in a calm and cool and collected and reasonable manner with all due respect and all due humility, but nevertheless to do it when Dad and I are alone. Or some other time when it just is very appropriate that we can talk through this and not in some forum where we know we're going to go away all of us mad. Got to change this. By the way, why do we need counselors? Brother Mark is here, I know. Why do people hang out a slate and say, I'm here as a counselor to help you? All they're really doing is saying, here's the form. I have time, and I have energy, and I will actually provide a platform for you to say what you want to say and to get out of your heart whatever is there, and I will assist you in doing that. And somehow, if the shingle is out, and I can't explain this either, if there's $20 involved in it, it seems like it's a more appropriate platform for this stuff to get discussed than it is after church, when I know full well that I have disagreed with the pastor on something, and it kind of eats at me and bothers me, it seems better to talk about this in the counselor's office, where the time and the place and the money and everything else, the forum is there. That's why we need the counselors, it seems to me. All they're really saying is, here is a place where we can talk about this. I don't want to take their job away. I just want to tell you that we could reduce the number of them if we would learn how to produce those same forums, those same places, those same opportunities as we go day by day in church community life and in school life and in family life. That's what it's about. I think that's the vision of Faith Builders Discipleship Program. Is just simply to learn how, when you're down here hanging drywall or something like that, and something is very irritating about how the other person does it, it's to rather than go hunting all over the place to find the administrator to take care of this, to create that form real quickly right there. Let's talk about this. Why aren't we getting along? What is the problem? What are you angry about? Can we discuss that? And we have found that there's a surprising number of things that will grow out of this approach. I really have only two basic things to say to you about this, I think. First, two words to help us to think about it. First word is attitude, and the second word is structure. If in our communities we are going to provide this platform that I'm talking about, then we must create a discipleship-oriented attitude. Brother John rightly asked the question, or who was it? Somebody here asked, what if, oh, it was Brother Strickler here, Brother James, said, what if they don't want it? How do you get people to want this? To be discipled. Well, I think that, yeah, we need an attitude adjustment pretty much throughout our communities on this. Somehow we actually enjoy this ABMS syndrome. It's part of the culture. Brother John Martin and I have talked about this a number of times. What is it that puts that fighting spirit in the Anabaptist community. That martyr complex, that I am right, and oh, I will die for what is right. I mean, it's obviously a good thing, but have you ever seen people get ready to die for something that surely was not worth dying about? But it's written into our complexity somewhere. I can't quite figure it out. I don't know if we read too much from the Martyr's Mirror. I don't know. My feeling has been we don't read enough from it, but it seems as though we're in that mode. We can't wait to go to that ABM meeting and just die, you know. I mean, we were the martyr. We got up and said what was right, and everybody was angry at us, but I just must bear this. Well, God help us. We need an attitude adjustment, I'm telling you. from our pulpits, it needs to begin right in the leadership of the church. Right there it has to start. Where we don't have this ludicrous complex that somehow or another, if I don't defend every little itty-bitty thing that I believe and think to the nth degree and stand ready to let relationships totally deteriorate because I'm going to insist on this. Somehow have it built into our leadership mentality. That's the way it's got to be. If we can't solve the problem there, I doubt we can solve it on lower levels. but their attitudes, I believe, need to change. A little statement here. This attitude adjustment needs to begin with the individual and broaden itself to include the corporate organizations, whatever they are, whether you're talking about the school or the church. So it first of all starts with me. Then it broadens. The attitude adjustment. Okay, I kind of doubt if I walked into any particular church and said, okay, we're gonna change the organizational attitude here today. That'll never happen. Unless we can first somehow speak down on the individual level and get at the thing that Brother James was talking about, and that is to get people to desire, to really want to experience change in their life. And I guess I would have one comment on that, and that is, when people see me change, if indeed that's the case, and people see my heart weep, and people see my life change, and my attitudes take on a newer meaning, and my personhood be clothed in the garment of righteousness and holiness, they cannot help but be attracted to that and say, I want the same. I want to be like that. Has that ever happened to you where you thought to yourself, boy, if I could just somehow get a hold of what that person has got, I'm not sure what they have, but whatever it is that they got, that's what I want. That person is ripe for discipleship, but we need some models for this. We need some models for this. So let it begin at the individual level. Milo already talked about some of these things, and so I told you I'm not going to talk about methods. But you're going to have to be able to receive it yourself. I mean, prepare your heart to receive criticism, to receive correction, to be told that you're wrong. We call this openness. Isn't it a blessing? Isn't it a refreshing thing when you run into an outstanding leader who, when you speak to them person on person, you just feel them open their heart up and say, brother, look at me. I'm not perfect. And I think that maybe you might have something to say to me. And you just see that leader with humility let his own life be spoken to. When that happens to him on an individual level, then you're ready to move to a corporate level of this. See, but you got to get it there somewhere to begin with. So now I'm going to jump back to school here a little bit. And we're talking about discipleship among parents, board, school staff, and students. I don't know what your position may be. I don't know if you're a principal or if you're a teacher or elementary principal or secretary or what your function may be in all of this, or a parent or a board member or student, wherever you're at. But somehow it begins on that level when we sense deep down in us from our own personal devotion before God that I have a need. I've stated this publicly before. I'll say it again. The greatest moments in my life spiritually have not been when there has been a powerful preacher speaking that moves me mightily and I want to cry. The greatest moments in my life have been in private devotions, spiritually now, private devotions at home early in the morning, reading through the scriptures or even praying, and all of a sudden say, Melvin, that is you. That's what that passage is talking about you. And in those moments that you sense that stinking, rotten pride that sits down in your life somewhere, is the moment that you're ready for the most significant growth in your experience. So I'm just saying, folks, if you want this to happen on an individual level, if you're a teacher and you want to somehow create a platform for good, solid discipleship in your classroom or in your among your faculty or wherever it is, then I suggest that you sit before God and wait before God until you see how wretched you are yourself. Perhaps then you will be prepared to welcome into your life the brother's admonition, or the parent who walks into your office and says, or into your classroom and says, I would like to talk to you about some things that, according to my Sally, is not going so well. You're probably ready for it then. Okay. But if in fact you are the discipler and you are better than everybody else and your pride hangs out on all sides, well then I don't think it's going to happen. It won't happen to you, and you won't make it happen in the classroom. And then just let that grow and broaden into corporate organizations. So reorient our attitudes. I have come to love the moments. I shouldn't say love the moments, but to recognize when I'm under fire, when the heat is on, when it's time for me to answer for my actions and my doings and sense it in my heart and all of that, something really significant is going to happen in a good way if I let it. Okay? And then that puts me in a position to move right through the structure, whatever it is, and begin to speak into the attitudes of other people and into their lives. Secondly, a disciple-oriented structure must exist. The larger the organization, the greater the distance between the rank and file member and leadership, and the greater the need for incremental steps that connect the rank and file member with leadership. I'm not sure if this is not where the problem is at. I heard a bishop say in our back home one time that if he would, in fact, make it a point to visit one family every week in the congregations that he was responsible for, it would take him 2 years to get around and back to the first family he went to visit. Something is wrong organizationally. Something is not right if, in fact, he's the one who is expected to do all this visitation and keep all of this stuck together somehow. It's too much distance between right where life is being lived in the families and those who are supposed to be leading out in discipleship issues. Think of the school. It's the same thing. The greater the distance between that person who is in some office that the student isn't even sure what office he's in. I went to public school. There were 2,000 students. That was a mistake. I didn't even know where the guidance counselor's office was at. I remember getting a pass one time to go see the guidance counselor, which I probably needed. But I didn't know where to go. Where's the office at? Well, down this hallway and over here and back here and do this and do that. You'll find him back there. I didn't know his name. They said, well, yeah, he's your guidance counselor. I said, okay. I'll go see him. So I did, and it was a nice discussion as far as that's concerned about my future. But way too much distance between me and him. How in How could you expect to give good counsel to a person if they don't even know where your office is? I sense both in our schools and in our churches that we're frightened. Why does a leader, why does a corporate executive have 18 offices between him and the person who's working down there in the floor? I'll tell you why. He doesn't want to see him. He doesn't want to see that person in his office at all. And so he's got all this distance built up in between him. He doesn't want that person coming into him and saying, listen, you're not paying the people on the floor enough. I'm tired of the conditions. He wants somebody else to take care of that. Okay? Then maybe somebody else should, as far as that's concerned. But too often I sense the same thing in our own circles. We really do not want to confront the problems, and so we let it organizationally in such a way so that we have the once a year meeting. And if we can just get through that confrontation so that everybody can take communion the next shot around, we're doing okay. We'll get around to the next time. Feels to me like we just as well not confront, but kind of know that some of them have to be that way. So we need to do something about that structure, I think. Well, I just have some practical advice on this, I believe. Use the existent authority structure, I believe, to make this work. Why not? As a teacher, who is the first line person to the heart of your student? I think Dad is. Isn't he the appropriate authority and discipler in line for his children? Well, sure he is. I suggest to you as a teacher, well, okay, why don't you start there? Why don't you make it a goal this year to develop a very healthy relationship with the dads of your students? What you're going to do is you're just going to set out to warm your heart up toward them and let their hearts warm towards you. Okay? Remember, we don't want to take away from the dads and the pastors and the people who are in charge of various things. We want to take away from them their responsibility. We only want to provide a platform for the action to take place. So why not resolve now that at least once a week, you're either going to make a telephone call, or you're going to think of something appropriate to say, write it in a note, or you're going to make sure that you stop by to see such and such John or James or whoever it is after church and just talk to them a little bit about how they feel about school. You need to bring it up. Did you ever run into this situation? You know there's something just not quite right. And so after church, sure enough, John is sitting right in front of you. And so he turns around, you shake his hand, and you small talk a little bit, and you kind of want to bring this up, but you're frightened. So you don't. Resolve now that when those opportunities come up, you're going to do it. What you're going to do is just simply talk to that dad about what the situation is. If you are a single sister and you are probably not in as appropriate of a position to work on some of this as others, still there is a way to do this. I have observed that young sisters who are very careful are able to bring these things up. You know, here's mom and here's dad together. And so the young sister makes the opportunity to just step right up and say, you know, I'd like to talk to you two about something. I'm seeing your Sally. There's something doesn't seem to be going very well. And could we just talk about that? Resolve now to take that step. If you're an administrator, I have a suggestion for you. Get to know your board chairman very well. Go out and jog with him if you need to. Whatever you got to do, create some kind of an opportunity that you're going to be with that board chairman. You want to talk about things. You want him to know that he can bring something to you personally long before it ever comes to the attention of the full board, and you'd be very open to hearing what he has to say. You want to give him the opportunity to speak into the situation before it emerges into this big public meeting where you got to deal with the issue. Use the existing authority structure to provide those incremental steps that build into a corporate attitude, see, of discipleship and of working with each other. Make it a point to get to know the pastor very well of the churches. I want to hand it to Brandon. Here at the early part of the summer, even though he was so busy, hardly knew whether he was coming or going, he scheduled some time to meet with the various pastors who send whose congregations send children here to our school. Needs to be way, way more of that. Even if it is your home community, just a time. If you got to do it like the counselors, do it. Schedule it. I have an old maxim. I tell all the people in principles of teaching, the surest way to make sure an event occurs is to schedule it. If you can't get it done any other way, then hang out your slate. Say, I'll meet with you between 4 and 5 on Saturday. Okay? Now, it's nice if it doesn't have to be done that way, but if that's the way it's got to be done, then do it. Pastor, I want to talk to you. This is your flock. These are your people. I recognize that. I think I might be able to help you. If we can just have opportunities to sit down now, and then I think I can give you some insights about the families in your church. I'd like to assist you. Don't get into the mode where you're against him. Don't get into the mode where you think that he's not good enough to do the job. Don't get into the mode where you think you've got to take his place. That's not what you're doing. What you're doing is you're providing him now a platform to do the discipling that he needs to do. Okay? When a pastor knows that you want to assist him, so you're not against it. Hey, I know how this works. I think I've seen this. You'll find a person who is very good relationally. He loves people and they kind of love him. He's got great personality. He's got great pizzazz. He's got all this stuff going for him. And so people naturally gravitate his direction or her direction. And the first thing you know, the pastor is feeling a little bit miffed. And I'm not saying he should. It might be his problem. And things don't seem the way they ought to be. If you're good at this and you're a principal in a school, woo that pastor into your discipleship thing. Bless him in his work. Provide for him the opportunities. Don't undermine him. Don't undercut what he's doing. See, because what we're after is these incremental steps. And I've already alluded to this. I just think those in leadership in our churches got way too much to do to try to do all of this. And I wish that we would learn how to do it on different levels. A big word in all of this, I think, is accountability. I think this is some of the reason of just saying, look, I want to meet with you, Dad. I'd like to talk to you, Father. The end of next week, I believe that Johnny is not doing too well in his assignments. This can be very, very painful. We want to hold each other accountable. I always look back. I painted that little scene for you where the boy was telling me about the inappropriate action of his father, and I had the opportunity to bring this to his attention. When I did, he sat there and looked at me probably for a full 30 seconds, 40 seconds, 50 seconds, never said a word. To my shame, and I am always embarrassed about this, and I talk about this, I left a drop there. It's a terrible mistake. I should have pushed on this a little harder. I should have shoved on this. And found out what was going on. I tell you what I wanted to do. I wanted to just call his pastor and tell his pastor, hey, you got a problem. Take care of this. And in fact, did do that to a certain extent. But always have felt like I needed a lot of discipleship in that issue myself. So I wasn't quite sure what to do and how to handle it. But accountability. See, that brother who was involved in that needed to be called into account. Just simply said, brother, if this is a problem in your life, can we talk about this and figure out why it is that you're so angry and you feel like you need to throw hammers at your sons now and then? Could we discuss that? Could we talk a little bit about why you feel a compulsion to hit your wife now and then? And this is a very, very difficult discussion, I know. But we need to have it. And then let the brother say what he needs to say. And work on it from there. And say, could we just meet now for the next... I'd like to talk to you a week from now. I want to know how it's going. And begin to hold each other in some level of accountable relationship. Okay? So we go incrementally from small to large as far as structure is concerned. I see I need to close here. I want to really, really just beg you to think about the small cell groups in your communities. This is on the large perspective as well as on a smaller perspective. Brandon, again, last year had even the school students meeting, I believe it was on Fridays or something like that, just in small groups of 3 and 4, sharing their concerns with each other, their personal concerns, and praying for each other. 11th and 12th graders can do this and ought to do it. Of course, it should be being done at home as well. I think sometimes leadership is frightened of this. You know, we've seen church splits grow out of home Bible studies, haven't we? And this type of thing. And this is why I'm urging us, if we are in a position to provide platforms for this kind of activity, draw the existing authority structure into it and have them participate and help them to do it. They tell me that one of the best groups that you can put together is not just two people. Surprisingly, you might think that just two people works the best. Actually, they tell me it works with three better. I don't have enough experience with it to say for sure. But I think I understand what they're talking about. I think for our congregation here, you know, we're battling right now. Not battling, we're wrestling. We're thinking through the issues. How do you have an effective congregational discipleship experience? And it seems to us very clear that you have to, in some way, build this from very small groups that circulate among each other so you stay away from exclusivism and elitism and all the stuff that goes along with it. But build it up from there into an accountable structure where people are really talking about significant things with each other and about their personal lives. Do you ever notice this? When we create a prayer list in prayer meeting, we can pray about almost anything except those things that are really significant in our lives at that point. You know, the neighbor's sick, and my grandmother just died, or this or that or the other thing. Good things to pray for. But pretty hard to get people to say, look, I am really struggling with an issue that I would like to tell you about and like for you to pray for me. You are more apt to share things on that level with a group of 3 people than you are in a group of 25. So structurally, I believe that we need to learn how to do this. Well, we're out of time. Structurally, you have to have time to do these things. You have to make time. And there are just a lot of small things. I jotted down a couple of them here, and I just mentioned one to give you an idea of how simple I think some things could be to reduce the distance that seems to exist between dads and sons and all this kind of stuff. This is not a big pick of mine, but it's just something that seems to me that would help. I see Leroy sitting back here in the middle of the congregation today. I see Brother John right up here, kind of, with the young folks right beside him and his son there. And my son sitting right here, and I see Reuben sitting here. I see Milo way back there in the corner. I think I'm pointing at ordained brothers. I'm not sure, but I think I am. You ordained, Reuben? Okay, I wasn't sure if you were or not. Why do we have to deliberately create distance? That does not seem wise to me. It seems to me like we ought to deliberately organize structures that reduce that distance. I like to see Leroy sitting back there. And when I, as director of this school, there was a person told me one time, I think they had been here for 6 months. This didn't happen intentionally, it just kind of happened. They all of a sudden said one day, oh, are you the director here? Yeah. I was glad that structurally, this is not reflecting me personally, I was glad that structurally here at this school, it's not all that obvious who's in charge of this and who's in charge of that and who does this and who, and I kind of like it just that we sit with the rest and we try to cry with the rest and we try to do the things with other people. Let's not create artificial distances. At least we can reduce those to bare minimum. So just, I'm trying to say to you that this does not have to be some big thing that seems beyond our reach. There are some things that would be pretty easy to do to start to get us to a place where this ongoing discipleship would happen. I close with 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, and I'm just going to read this passage and sit down. Chapter 4, verse 12. Just notice the first phrase in this exhortation from Paul. And we beseech you, brethren, to know them which labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you and to esteem them very highly in love for their work's sake. I said I was just going to read it. I wanted to say something earlier and forgot, and I have to say this. The two things that will make this work the very best, get this down. The two attitudes that you need that will make this tick. Number one is humility, and number two is respect. Every person deserves your respect. The highest level of respect. I don't care if he's the brat in your classroom or who he is. If you know how to give respect to another person, they'll give it back to you and you will have a platform for discipleship. But if you do not know how to give respect to other people, you're sunk before you start. I was going to read Philippians chapter 2 earlier and talk about that from the standpoint of Jesus. Okay? He was humble. That deserved actually the whole hour that I talked. Should have been spent on that. I'm sorry. Please take that and think about it. Humility and respect. So in verse 13, to esteem them very highly in love for their work's sake, and be at peace among yourselves. Now we exhort you, brethren, warn them that are unruly, comfort the feeble-minded, support the weak, be patient toward all men, see that none render evil for evil unto any man, but ever follow that which is good, both among yourselves and to all men. Rejoice evermore, pray without ceasing. In everything give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus concerning you. Quench not the spirit, despise not prophesying, prove all things, hold fast that which is good, abstain from all appearance of evil. In the very God of peace sanctify you wholly. And I pray God your whole spirit and soul and body be preserved blameless unto the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. Faithful is he that calleth you, who also will do it. Brethren, pray for us. Greet all the brethren with a holy kiss. I charge you by the Lord and this epistle, that this epistle be read unto all the holy brethren. The grace of our Lord Jesus Christ be with you. Amen.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit ChristianLearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the DocForLearning.org.